All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. General Robert N. Davis presiding. All our business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this fine court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Senior Judge Davis. I'm not a senior judge. Maybe I'm thinking ahead too much here. I am Chief Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Bartley, and to my left is Judge Allen. We're here today in the matter of Simmons against Wilkie, docket number 16-3039. We've identified a number of panel issues, and the court issued a supplemental briefing memorandum on January of 2018, and we'll probably like to focus on the questions asked in the supplemental briefing order, but for purposes of summary, let me just indicate what we're looking at panel issues. What is the limit of the court's ability to make factual determinations in the context of its harmless error analysis? What is the proper test for determining that an error is prejudicial to an appellant? What does the term trial de novo mean in the context of this case? And may the court make findings of fact on matters not addressed by the board in the decision on appeal? The January 2018 supplemental briefing order asked five questions. What is the proper understanding of the scope of Section 7261C, which prohibits the court from conducting trial de novo? What is the proper standard for the court to employ in making factual determinations pursuant to the harmless error analysis? What is the proper test for making the ultimate determination whether an error was harmful? Four, given that Q was adjudicated under the record and the law that existed at the time of the prior decision, would the court's prejudicial error analysis differ when assessing the prejudicial effect of a Q decision? And finally, in undertaking a harmless error analysis, are there any limitations to the court's ability to make legal determinations, find facts, and apply the law to facts? Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record? Mr. Carpenter, I am so happy to see you recovered and back. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mark Igor, the Secretary of the Council's Table, is Ken Walsh.
Thank you both. Mr. Walsh, thank you for your service on our committee. Are both parties ready to proceed? Each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Mr. Carpenter, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Court. Ken Carpenter, appearing on behalf of Mr. Reese. Before I begin, Your Honor, without any intent of offering the questions in some briefing order, I believe that there is an obligation on my part to bring to the court's attention something that has occurred to me in trying to prepare for this oral argument, and that is this court's decision in Archer v. Principe at 3 Ben F. 433, a 1992 case of this court. I am not sure, under the holding in Archer, that this court can reach any of the questions that have been posed in the supplemental briefing order, specifically the question of whether or not the board correctly determined that the record does not show a manifestly changed outcome, because to do so would involve this court undertaking a plenary review of the underlying decision, particularly in the context of the allegations of clear and unmistakable error made by Mr. Simmons. Rather, this court's jurisdiction in case of clear and unmistakable error that is decided either in reviewing a board decision or reviewing a regional office decision, is to determine only whether that decision was arbitrary, capricious, an abuse of discretion, or otherwise not in accordance with law under Section 7261A3, capital A. As I understand Archer, this court's review is limited to an examination of error made by the board and not the ultimate question of whether or not the board correctly determined whether or not the record did or did not show a manifestly different outcome. As I read the court's questions, all of those questions go to that ultimate question of whether or not there was or was not a clear and unmistakable error in this case. With respect, that issue is not before this court. The affirmative of error made by Mr. Simmons was twofold, that the board failed to correctly apply 38 U.S.C. 105 small a, or 38 U.S.C. section 111, the presumption of service connection under 105 and the presumption of soundness under section 111.
Mr. Carpenter, in assessing whether or not under the Q analysis error was committed and under the second prong, whether or not there was a manifestly changed outcome, under the proper standard of arbitrary and capricious, don't you think part of the assessment of that might raise some of these issues?
I do believe that, Your Honor, but I have been rebuffed by this court when attempting to do so with this decision in Archer.
Right.
And have been told that this court is not reviewing the underlying decision, particularly those two elements, mm-hmm. and clearly, at least as the pre-briefing order was framed, the court has asked the parties to assume that there is a violation of 105A that was made by the board. If that's the case, then to me, that is the end of the matter when you do a proper analysis of what the failure to consider a statutory or regulatory presumption is. And that is a prejudicial error because the function of any statutory or regulatory presumption is to fill an evidentiary gap. In this case, it is the question of the second element of the three elements of service connection of incurrence. And that was, under the proper application of both of these presumptions, to presume that there was an incurrence unless that presumption can be rebutted.
Well, don't we nevertheless have a statutory duty to take account of prejudicial error?
You do, Your Honor. But
and are you saying that Archer basically created some kind of exception to that?
Not to consideration of prejudicial error. Prejudicial error still has to be considered in relationship to the board's failure to correctly apply 105A. That determination is a separate inquiry for harmless error from the one that was proposed in the pre-briefing order. The one that is proposed in the pre-briefing order is that we examine whether or not the board correctly decided to manifest a different outcome element of the Q analysis. To do that, you violate Archer, at least in my judgment. Now, if the court does not think that is correct, I'm happy to address the issues and allow this court to go forward and make its decision on that analysis, because I think even under that analysis, although I believe it violates Archer, the board was clearly in error. Number one,
Well, I'd like you to go ahead with the analysis, but I did have one before we even get to the briefing order. I wanted you to address the fact that several times in your brief, you mentioned, and I think you might have done this in the supplemental briefing as well, you mentioned that the June 74 opinion was actually contained favorable nexus evidence.
Yes.
So can you explain that? Because I looked at that opinion, and I'm not quite getting it.
Well, the June 1974 opinion which is in the record at 1448, or no, sorry, it's at 49. I think at least is that the same record that we're talking about. Is a record that in the second paragraph says, I had examined the medical records supplied me concerning his illness while in the United States Navy from August 1968 to January 1970. I believe it is a reasonable presumption that the illness manifested as mental depression during that time is the same illness that is now being manifested as arthritis involving multiple joints. Now, in my view, that paragraph is an adequate relationship between what was identified in service under the presumption as a mental disorder. And that mental disorder was variously characterized, but in the main, as depression. The first incident that precipitated it was an admission to the hospital following an attempted suicide. Clearly, we have an event in service that dealt with a mental disorder. We have post-service evidence that this veteran is suffering from a disability. As this court noted in Clemens, there is no obligation on the part of the veteran to know or understand the medical nuances of his or her disability. In this case, this doctor is characterizing what happened post-service in the context of what he describes as arthritis involving multiple joints. But he clearly states that that is the same illness that was present and identified as depression in service. So the labels, if you will, are not relevant. What is relevant is whether or not there is a post-service disability that is found to be related to an in-service injury or disease or an event. And I believe that this document covers that. And even if this court were not to find that to be true, at the very least, it requires a remand for the board to address that.
But what your motion, I'm not sure, I can't recall whether it was your cue motion, I think it was your cue motion that was filed. That was as to the denial of service connection for a psych disorder, not as to the 74 denial of arthritis.
I think it's important to go back to the record at 52. On June 11th of 1974, what Mr. Simmons requested was that his claim be reopened for compensation, and these are his words, since there is a reasonable presumption that my rheumatoid arthritis condition was manifested as a direct result of my mental depression in service and culminated in my administrative discharge. That's the issue that was presented against the claim made by Mr. Simmons in 1974. The decision made by the VA was to bifurcate that into a rheumatoid arthritis claim and a nervous condition claim, both of which were denied. In this case, I believe we have a medical chicken and the egg situation. Without being able to identify which came first, the depression or the rheumatoid arthritis, and the VA, in its 1974 decision, made no attempt to look at these as being interrelated other than to say, I believe in the decision, that it is not shown that the arthritis was manifested within 1 year of following service to cover the presumptive portion of the arthritis as a chronic disease. The point being in this case, though, Your Honor, is that the allegation of error made by Mr. Simmons in both his request for revision and in his briefing to this court was that the VA failed to correctly apply 105A and 1111. It is, in my view, not debatable that that occurred. What, in fact, the board did in its decision was merely to decide that the regulations involving personality disorder somehow trumped those statutory presumptions, and therefore they weren't required to apply them.
Right, but my question was your motion, which I think was filed December 2005?
Yeah.
Was that as to mental alone, or was that as to their decision as to arthritis?
It was purposely made as to mental alone because there was no evidence of arthritis in service or within the presumptive period. The diagnosis of arthritis came outside the one-year presumptive period. In our view, the only substantive way that we could seek revision was on the failure of the VA to afford the veteran the benefit of the presumption of service connection for his mental disorder. And had they done that, they would have been required to assume incurrence, and then even if you reject the evidence of a post-service diagnosis and nexus, the VA would have been under an obligation, once correctly applying those presumptions, to have developed evidence to determine whether there was or was not a post-service disability, and whether or not that post-service disability was at least as likely as not related to the in-service incident.
Could I ask one question which didn't occur to me until you were talking now? But we sort of have to take as a given that the arthritis was not service-connected, right? Because that,
yes,
right, that decision is final, and so we take that as the world, okay? But yet the favorable evidence that you were talking about with Judge Bartley a moment ago seems to be saying that these conditions were secondary to the arthritis. Is there any impact of the fact that we have to assume that the arthritis itself then wasn't service-connected, which means it didn't actually occur in service? And so is that evidence really favorable when it has that factual predicate that we have to assume is not true?
I believe under this Court's analysis in Clemens, this Court must do that because it is not incumbent upon the veteran to understand the relationship between what happened to him and even the full nature and scope of what was his resulting disability thereafter. You are correct that technically there was no primary condition in order to be secondarily service connected. I would suggest that based upon the evidence that was in the record in 1974, that there was more than enough evidence to support the application of both 105A and 1111 to establish the incurrence element. And therefore, the focus should have been on the mental disorder. And then the question is, does the record 49 raise a reasonable possibility that there is, one, a post-service disability, and two, if there is a post-service disability, is it at least as likely as not that that post-service disability was related to what happened in service? He framed his, as I indicated, his claim as a reasonable presumption that his rheumatoid arthritis condition was manifest as a direct result of his mental depression in service and culminated in his administrative discharge from service. So what we're dealing with here is an error of law in a failing to afford that presumption. Once that presumption is established as being applicable, and I believe both presumptions are, then the VA had an affirmative duty to, one, recognize that incurrence had been established, and then develop the record accordingly. This decision clearly indicated that no effort whatsoever was made to do that, that they treated them as two separate incidents, even though they acknowledged that there was evidence of some possible secondary correlation between the two. This is a defective decision as a matter of law. because it began with an error of law by not affording him the presumption of the incurrence element. That is an indisputable fact in this record. That was, therefore, a clear and unmistakable error, and the question then becomes only whether or not that was a manifestly different outcome. And that is an issue for the board to have decided, not the way in which the board decided it by posing a hypothetical to say, well, even if there was an error, there would not have been.
So that's what I want to ask. Why isn't that a finding of the board that then we would review in this case? In other words, you started out with Archer saying we don't get to the prejudicial error in that way. But the board did here find that it wasn't, it wouldn't have manifestly changed the outcome.
And I believe under 7104D, you can certainly review that as being an inadequate statement of reasons or bases for both of the prongs of the even if and the conclusion that there was no manifestly different outcome.
So
that is a different analysis, in my view, than what I understood this court wanted us to be discussing.
Well, but I think we might be getting there right now, right? So assume we look at the manifestly different outcome conclusion, and we think, okay, there was a reasons and basis problem. The board didn't explain why it reached that. Let's just assume that. Wouldn't then, at that point in time, our obligation to take due account of the rule of prejudicial error kick in and have us decide, but it doesn't matter because we can construct for ourselves why this wasn't manifestly different?
I think vis-a-vis that route, you could. What I understood the direction in the supplemental briefing order, however, was, is that we were to assume that there was a violation of 105A. That, to me, is a different proposition, because we were directed to make that assumption and not make the assumption that there was an inadequate statement of reasons or bases about the manifestly different outcome.
Mr. Carpenter, I'm having trouble understanding where that assumption comes from when you look at the briefing order.
The briefing order at page... In the second paragraph, it says, assuming without deciding, the board erred regarding section 105, but that such an error is non-prejudicial because the board correctly determined that the record does not show a manifestly changed outcome.
Right. Without deciding. Assuming
yes.
Without deciding.
Well, yes.
Right.
And clearly, I don't think you could have directed a verdict, as it were.
Right.
I just want to make sure I understand this because it's a hard thing, and I'm gonna I think take you over your time, and hopefully the chief judge will let you go. But let's just assume then. Start with the assumption. Okay, the board in the decision that we're reviewing now made a mistake in not concluding that 105A should have been applied in 1974. Okay, let's assume we look at that, we make that call. We still have an obligation at that point to do something with respect to the rule of prejudicial error, right? Right?
Yes, and my assertion is that that goes to the 105 error. And the 105 error is the failure to afford the veteran the benefit of the statutory presumption of service connection, the element of incurrence. And that is where you make your harmless error or prejudicial error analysis as to when they failed to apply it, what was the effect of that? The effect of
who's they? When they fail to, is it the board,
not the agency in the original decision.
But in order, and I'm not arguing with you. I'm really trying to grasp this. How would we do that to determine that there was error without considering the 1974 decision? That's the problem that I'm having.
I believe, Your Honor, that your consideration, at least as I read Archer is limited to what the board did and how the board did it, not what the agency did in 1974 and how they did it. And in this case, the board said that it was not necessary to consider either of those presumptions because they were trumped by the existence of two regulations that precluded an immature personality disorder, which was not claimed, from being service-connected. That is an incorrect application of the 105A presumption. The 105A presumption has only one function, one purpose, to substitute the evidence of incurrence and say to the VA, you must presume that this assertion of injury or disease happened while on active duty, that the incurrence element is met. And once that incurrence element is not met, then the continued adjudication of that claim is prejudicially defective, because you cannot deny the veteran, as was done here by the board, the benefit of that presumption. They basically said in this case, yes, there's a statutory presumption under 105 and there's a statutory presumption under 1111, but you, Mr. Simmons, you're not entitled to those, because those somehow, and it's not explained in the decision, are trumped by the regulations concerning the prohibition of personality disorder from being compensable. But his claim was not for personality disorder. If it was not for personality disorder, then the presumption can only apply to the two claims that the VA actually adjudicated. And the only one that applies to is the nervous condition, the mental disorder.
But why under 7261C can't we just go ahead? Okay, yeah, the board did err in some respect as to 105. But we go ahead and follow through the analysis if they had applied it. He wouldn't have won anyway. And I would point to, you keep saying we have to stop at a certain point, but I mean, we have a lot of case law. King, Bustos, I think King said it probably most directly, that, you know, a change in the outcome means that you would have won instead of lost. And so I know I'm a little bit mixing the final step of Q with the harmless error analysis, and that raises a good question, like, is there any difference between the two? But also, my primary question is, under the taking into account of prejudicial error, why can't we do that, regardless of what error the board made? We have the statutory obligation to undertake that analysis.
Please do not understand anything that I'm saying to suggest that you do not have the obligation to take into account prejudicial error. I believe that there is no question that you must take into account. The question is, which error and how do you take into account? Under Archer, I believe you're prohibited from getting to that manifestly different outcome piece because it's part of the 1974 it's part of the allegation of Q. The allegation of Q is not before this court. What is before this court is whether or not they did or didn't correctly apply 105 or 1111. Those were the two averments of error made by Mr. Simmons. And therefore,
and can you, whenever you say they, would you, as Judge Allen requested, just clarify who and not use they?
I'm only referring to the board.
But the board now, right? So it doesn't apply 105. Let's just assume it should have applied it, and it didn't. The only way, and I might be just being really slow here, but the only way to figure out whether that is harmful would be, I think, what Judge Bartley is saying, because otherwise the flip is failure to apply any statutory or regulatory provision in a Q analysis would then, by definition, be what Sanders says can't be, right? Presumptively error, right? Meaning harmful, presumptively harmful. So let me try this again. What would we look at? So we write an opinion and we say the board here in the decision on review should have applied 105A, and it did not. Now we will decide whether there is prejudicial error flowing from that. What would we say if we wouldn't talk about the fact, but it wouldn't have made a difference in 1974?
Because the answer to the question is not would it have made a difference in 1974, but in terms of prejudicial error, would the error have made a difference in the board's decision? And it would have made a difference in the board's decision, because the board would have, as they did not, have been required to analyze how 105 and 1111 should have been applied in 1974. To put it another way, Judge Allen, any time your prejudicial error analysis looks at how there would have been a different outcome in 1974, that exceeds Archer. Your prejudicial error analysis must be, how does the board's error in failing to apply 105A affect the outcome of the board's decision?
Yeah, but, okay, but I'm kind of like, I agree with what you just said to some extent, but let's say that we find, let's say we disagree with you that the June 74 opinion is a positive linkage opinion, then wouldn't the board's error as to 1111 and as to 105, or any error that was there, I'm not conceding that there was error there, any error as to 1111 as to 105 would have been harmless, because you don't have the third shed-in element, or, you know, the third element of service connection.
Well, the reason that you wouldn't is because the board didn't. If the board had, then you would have some basis to determine that it would have been a harmless error. But in this case, the board applied neither of those two presumptions. Therefore, you do not have the benefit of a board decision which applied those. It is, I believe, comparable to this court's inability, I'm blanking on the Supreme Court decision's name, that prohibits you from deciding the case on a different ground. Okay, thank you very much, Your Honor. I completely blind. It is comparable to Chenery, because you are making a decision on a different ground. In this case, you're making a decision, you're making a harmless error analysis based upon an analysis that never took place, an application of both of these that never took place. When a veteran, as here, makes an allegation of Q, that two specific statutes were not correctly applied, two statutory provisions were not afforded to the veteran, the board has an obligation to address those. The way in which they were addressed in this case was to say, not necessary, because these regulations trump that. That is a legal error. That's an error of law. This court's review is only of what the board said. When the board said that, that was wrong, and the failure to afford those presumptions was prejudicial. And you have to look to the absence of any explanation for why they didn't as to whether or not it was prejudicial to say they're not applicable because these regulations regarding personality disorder preclude consideration of those presumptions. That's just not correct at law. So it needs to go back for the board to do this again based upon the allegation that. And I think if you do otherwise, if you do as is inferred in the briefing order, that you're going to be violating your own precedent in Archer.
Well, Mr. Carpenter, we'll note your concern for the record, but leave it to the court to decide what it's violating or not. And let's get on with some of the other issues that we've raised in the briefing order, if we could.
I think, frankly, I've covered everything
you have.
That I intended to cover in my opening, unless process for the budget committee or not.
Could I ask one, which is, what is your understanding of the difference, if any, between the manifestly changed outcome prong of Q and taking due account of prejudicial error?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm aware of any cases that make that comparison.
I don't think there are any.
sense of it is correct that there is. It's hard to distinguish between the two. But to me, that only reinforces the need to differentiate between what the board did as an error and what may or may not have been done as a clear and unmistakable error by the agency in 1974.
So here's the... take a hypothetical situation, not this decision here, because we will then debate about whether it did it. Let's assume we have a board decision on a Q motion that has a full-throated, fulsome analysis of the manifestly different outcome prong. And a veteran challenges that before the court. So I think we would then review that determination under the arbitrary and capricious standard, right? So, if we found it to be arbitrary and capricious, right, we would then, though, still have to decide whether or not the prejudicial error flowed from that?
Yes.
And so that would allow us then to do a lot more than just looking at whether something is arbitrary. We'd be able to do something more.
Certainly. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, so it's just that's the part I'm wrestling with about whether then the two analyses are actually the same or not.
Well, but the differential is that as opposed to the predicate in the briefing order of a 105A violation, your hypothetical shifts to the second prong of the Q analysis, and it presupposes a full analysis by the board. None of those things are present in this case. I believe your hypothetical would have to result in a prejudicial error analysis because A, there was an application, and B, there was a full discussion of why they did what they did. And if the court then agrees with that conclusion and concludes, but there's no error, then I believe that that's entirely consistent with your obligation to take into account the rule of prejudicial error. But Mr. Simmons and every other veteran who makes a request for revision has a right to have his Q allegation reviewed by the board when it is denied. And in this case, it was denied and it was reviewed by the board. And there was no discussion of 105 and 1111 except to say they are neutralized by the agency. Stay inside that glass.
Anything else?
No. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. At the outset, I'd like to cover the very first step of the analysis here, which is, of course, to determine whether there actually is error in the board's decision. And it would be the central position that there is no error in the board's decision with respect to 105A. The board determined that 105A does not apply, or rather did not apply, in 1974. And that determination is correct. In order for 105A to apply, we need to have a disease or injury fit that occurred during service that 105A would operate to presume is incurred during service. And it's Mr. Simmons' contention, based on the April 1969 evaluations, that there is such a disease or injury that occurred during service, namely the notations of an acute anxiety disorder or depression reaction. However, he omits that later that same year, in December 1969, there was an additional evaluation by a service department examiner, which found those exact same symptoms to be an immature personality, a personality disorder, and that is not a disease or injury by regulation. And it's clear in looking at the RO's 1974 decision that the RO actually credited that latter finding. It found that there was no disease or injury incurred during service. And absent a disease or injury in service, 105A has no application.
Let me ask you one quick question about that. When I was thinking about this, depending on how you looked at it, it sort of looks different. It's a different perspective. But the way you just framed that is one of the ways to look at this, which is that the agency in that earlier decision made a factual determination about something. They made a factual determination. Which might have been right or it might have been wrong, but it was a factual determination. And how does that play into this? Because it seems to me that there's at least some law out there that we couldn't review or nobody could review on a Q motion, the balancing of whether the fact was determined correctly.
Yes, Your Honor. There are kind of two prongs to one of your latter statements there, and I would agree with them both. We're at Q here. The board's analysis here was whether or not it was clear and unmistakable error in the RO decision. So to the extent the RO made a factual finding, then to the extent there is evidence to support that finding, the board can't look beyond that. The board can't reweigh the evidence at Q. And in looking at the record, there is indeed evidence to support the RO's determination that there was no disease or injury incurred during service, insofar as there is an in-service evaluation stating that these symptoms, these reactions, whatever they were a personality disorder. So insofar as there is evidence to support the RO's determination, once that decision becomes final and becomes subject to the Q standard, no one can second guess that. It simply can't be reopened and replayed.
Would there be any problem? Let's just assume that we agree with you the whole way. Would there be any problem with using that as a basis for a decision here? When the board didn't actually advance that itself as a reason? In other words, the board didn't say, there can't be Q here because this is based on a factual determination, a factual call made in 1974, and therefore, because that can't serve as the basis of Q, given that there's some evidence in the record to support that factual blah, blah, blah. I mean, would we still be able to get there if we wanted to?
You would, Your Honor. I guess first, I would submit that the board actually did get there to the extent that they said that 105A does not apply, but to operate in the world of...
That was very persuasive. Thank you.
To operate in the world of your hypothetical, could the court get to kind of the framework that I proposed earlier, and yes, you certainly could. Again, the board's analysis here, the board's focus is whether or not there was a clear and undebatable error, and as a second prong, whether that error manifestly changed the outcome. And under the standard for looking at prejudicial error that the court announced in Mayfield and in Kennedy Fogan, it's always appropriate to look at the outcome of the board's determination in looking to whether there was prejudicial error. If that outcome was correct, notwithstanding any error the board may have made, then that will always be harmless error. And the outcome of the board's determination here is, was there or was there not Q? And that, and baked into that question is whether the outcome in 1974 was manifestly changed. So once there is a determination of error, whatever it may be, the court can then look to the board's decision and say, had the board not made that error, would the board have concluded that the 1974 decision manifestly would have been different? And the answer to that is no here. And the board explained that, well, I've given you one reason based on the record that I think is clearly supported by the board's decision, and the board gave you a second reason. That regardless of how 105A may operate here, whatever may have been incurred during service, there still is no nexus, or I should say there is still unfavorable evidence with respect to the elements of nexus. There's, of course, there's at best conflict on that point. There's a record at page 49 that Mr. Simmons points to as favorable evidence. And my reading of that is that it's actually unfavorable evidence, but even assuming that it's favorable, there nonetheless remains the August 1974 VA psychiatric examination, which is unequivocally negative evidence insofar as it says the psychiatric disability, the anxiety reaction, depressive features, is related to the rheumatoid arthritis, which is a non-service connected disability. That service connection for that disability was denied in that very same decision. That's not challenged here. That was and is a non-service connected disability, and there simply is no basis for granting service connected disability benefits based on relation to a non-service connected disability. So the mere presence of, at most, at best, conflict in the record would preclude a finding by the board that the 1974 decision would have been manifestly different, because the board indeed no one can simply reweigh the facts as they were in 1974 because of the nature of the Q analysis. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. How do you understand the just conceptually any room between manifestly different that analysis and the analysis of taking into account of prejudicial error? Do you see them being the same thing or different?
In most cases, indeed, I would suggest almost all cases where this court is making a determination by the board with respect to Q, the two analyses really would collapse. Because where you're looking at the outcome of the board's decision, you're necessarily looking to how the board would have looked at the earlier decision, and that really imports the Q standard. But it really harkens back to the standard for prejudicial error, which the court again announced in Mayfield and again in Hogan, where you really are looking to the interest that's affected by the error. And typically at Q, what we're talking about is something like Mr. Simmons alleges here, where the board purportedly misapprehended some law or overlooked some fact. And that is an error that just necessarily is going to go to the outcome. You can look to the outcome. Indeed, you can always look to the outcome in Mayfield. Bogan standard, if that outcome is unchanged, that is not prejudicial. But there are other types of errors that the board could have committed. The only one that I've been able to envision that would really cause any daylight between the two standards is something that happened in the board's proceedings. Say, for example, Federer asked for a copy of his claims file to better flesh out his arguments with respect to Q, and he was never provided with the claims file. That is something where you wouldn't look to the changed outcome in that respect, because the interest isn't with respect to the outcome. The interest is with respect to participation in the current proceedings. So the prejudice is different. So you wouldn't need to get to that. But apart from that example, really, like I said, typically all Q cases will look to the outcome. And you can't always look to the outcome. But it again depends on the error and whether that is an error where the interest really goes to the outcome.
Mr. Gore, on page 9 of your response to the supplemental briefing order, you kind of distinguish the harmless error test, at least in your construct, from the standard under Q. On the request for revisions on manifestly changing an outcome. And I thought that it made sense because your point was that the harmless error test should require the appellant to show that an error affected the essential fairness of the adjudication. And then you went on in the next paragraph at the bottom of page 9 to say, once the error of fact or law is found, the question isn't really what's harmless or whether or not it's harmless, I'm sorry, but whether or not correcting that error would change the outcome. And that seems to me to actually present some daylight between the harmless and error analysis and the manifestly changed outcome analysis.
I would tend to agree, Your Honor. Really, I think they're opposite sides of the same coin, in that in looking at the essential fairness, as the court explained in Mayfield, what you're getting at there is the interest. Whatever error was made, whatever obligation the board failed to meet, looking at the interest and what interest that obligation seems to serves to protect, and whether the board's error with respect to that interest undermines the essential fairness of the proceedings, and that fairness really, like I mentioned a minute ago, really depends on the type of error, and usually. With Q, that will be looking at the outcome, and again, under the Mayfield standard, you can always look to the outcome. If we can be certain that the outcome did not change, then of course there's no impact on the fairness of the proceeding. Because if regardless the claim would have been denied, there's no unfairness in denying a non-meritorious claim, regardless of whatever errors may have happened along the way.
Now, Sanders laid out these factors that should inform a harmless error analysis, and they spoke of, well, the first one is very familiar to us, an estimation of the likelihood that the result would have been different. but they also laid out some other factors, an awareness of what body has the authority to reach that result, a consideration of the error's likely effects on perceived fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings, hesitancy to generalize too broadly about particular kinds of errors when the specific factual circumstances in which the error arises might make a difference. Now, so I'd say generally, this court looks at the first of those, you know, with the outcome change. But what are your thoughts on how those other factors could play into our harmless error determination in this case and also generally? I'm curious.
Generally, again, just I'm sorry, I sound like a bit of a broken record here, but again, it really all harkens back to the Mayfield standard, and and it really looks to what kind of error occurred and what interests that error affects. Naturally, if we're talking about something like a notice error that occurred at the outset with a claimant not receiving notice of the types of evidence that could be submitted to support the claim, or failing to receive notice that he or she could participate in a hearing, naturally you're not going to look to the outcome so much as you're going to look at a different interest, which is the interest to fully and fairly participate in the proceedings. And to simply say that, well, on this evidence, the outcome would have been the same doesn't make a lot of sense in that kind of situation, because the error affected the body of evidence that you even be looking at. The error really precedes all of that. And that speaks to one of the factors you noted, Your Honor, that namely the perception of fairness and integrity in the process. It's difficult to say it's good enough where a person wasn't even allowed to participate in proceedings. And that all flows from recognition of what the error is we're talking about and what interests that error affected. And I think that's really what the Supreme Court was getting at, is that we don't want to make presumptions, hard and fast rules, when we're talking about harmless error, prejudicial error. And that's an observation the court made as far back as 1946 in Koniakos, noting that this type of analysis just does not lend itself to bright line rules. It's a very highly case-specific determination where you just have to understand what error was made and what interest that error affects.
So, but to follow on to Judge Bartley's questions about Sander, just one thing, which is, I appreciate your distinction between, say, a notice error and I'm going to call it a substantive error. I mean, the Q error, right? But the first element or the first factor that Sanders talks about essentially is, would the outcome have been different, right? So if we're in that sort of center of what the Q is, so the error that we're talking about that we might find is not a notice error, it's really about the substance of Q, would we ever, in a prejudicial error analysis, reach any other factor from Sanders, given the fact that the entire thing with Q is it has to have manifestly changed the outcome? Do you see what I'm saying?
I do. And again, typically, you wouldn't. And indeed, again, you can always look to the outcome. The court made that clear in Mayfield. If we have certainty that the outcome would not have changed, that is always harmless, regardless of what type of error we're talking about, whether it's notice, duty to assist, reasons and basis, anything really. If we still have the certainty that the outcome was the same, then that is harmless. Some errors, it's difficult to reach that level of certainty, but as you know, with Q, where the definition of the error itself really goes to the outcome, almost always that is going to be the focus of the prejudicial error analysis. And just due to the certainty that's required by Q, I hesitate to say easy, but it's much more common to find that harmless error because of cases like these, where something as minor as mere conflict in the record necessarily means that it is not outcome determinative. Where there's any doubt in the record, then there's no doubt as to Q on the collateral attack of the earlier decision.
Mr. Gore, given the discussion that we're having and the questions in the supplemental briefing order, is there guidance that this court can offer in a presidential opinion in this area?
The court has answered most of the questions, I think, already, whether in Mayfield, Provokin, or Roberson. Most of those questions are already subject to presidential decisions of either this court or the Federal Circuit. To the extent the court finds some lack of clarity in that existing precedent, of course, the court can always offer some additional synthesis of the various presidential decisions, regulations, and law. I guess the answer would be yes. I certainly don't want to tell the court what sort of guidance is necessary, but that's certainly be helpful to any litigants that are pursuing to understand exactly the nature of what the court's inquiry will be.
To your knowledge, there's no case that talks about this, whether there's space between these two, to what extent there's space between these two, the last prong of Q, manifestly different outcome, and prejudicial error.
Well, I'm not aware of cases specifically hitting that precise point. I think the cases do certainly provide the answer to that, but I don't think that it's been explicitly spelled out. To answer your question, I guess the answer might be skirting around it somewhat, but I think the answers certainly are out there in presidential decisions, but not precisely on the question you asked.
Because this, it strikes me that, and I haven't gone back and reread Archer. I may never have read Archer, but taking Mr. Carpenter's point, if that stood for the proposition that generally the court doesn't look through the board decision to look at the earlier agency decision in a Q context, it does strike me, thinking out loud here, that if there isn't in most cases a difference between manifestly changed outcome and prejudicial error analysis, it does strike me that it may be that Archer's statement, let's just take it as true, that we don't look through the one decision to reach the other, isn't necessarily true once we get to the harmless error analysis, because if the harmless error analysis embodies manifestly changed outcome, that looks at the earlier decision. It has to, by definition. Right, so I think the cases might not be quite as clear necessarily in spelling that out.
Well, again, Your Honor, it's really in the nature of the Q analysis that once you reach the prejudicial error prong of that, then they collapse to some extent, but at the same time they don't. The court isn't reviewing the earlier decision for whether it contained Q. It's looking at whether the board could have found Q in that. And it's a fine distinction, but I think a critical one. I guess I wouldn't say that Archer has lost its salience at all in any sense, so much as it's just important to keep in mind which decision one's actually talking about when you reach the prejudicial error standard. if did that make sense, Your Honor?
Well, it did. I'm finding this to be a little bit, and this is not a problem with you or Mr. Carpenter, but this is, it's a hard distinction to keep in mind once you decide that in a Q context, if I were a board member, if I were a veterans law judge, I would be looking at the manifestly changed outcome, and the place I would be looking would be in our case here, I would be looking back to 1974. And if, in fact, on a prejudicial analysis, now that I'm on this court, I can't look to the 1974 decision. I have to look at what this board would have done had it considered manifestly changed outcome, but of course that takes you back to 1974. So I understand perfectly your theoretical distinction between that, and I think it's right. It's difficult to think how in practicality that, you know, you keep your boxes separate.
The lines certainly do blur, and that really is, again, a product of what Q is, because typically the board... Board's decisions are typically de novo in nature. They're deciding the claim anew without reference to any other decision. Q is unique in that regard, in that the board really is acting, it's not technically accurate, but it's acting more as an appellate body. Its decision is bound by a highly deferential standard of review, which is rare, in that they're typically deciding anew, but when they are operating under a deferential standard of review, and then this court's review of that review is also deferential, the lines certainly do blur. At this point,
I wanted you to address one other thing. Sure. You argued in the supplemental briefing that the court is limited in the harmless error analysis to the record before the agency at the time of the decision that's being challenged for Q. But we do have language in Bogan and other cases that talks about looking at the entire record. Can you just address, how you came down on that and what were your considerations?
Certainly. Again, it harkens back to what we're talking about with an outcome in Q. If we're looking at the outcome of the board's decision, which was whether there was Q in the earlier decision, the board can only find Q in the earlier decision based on the record as it was, in this case, in 1974. So even in a harmless error context, we couldn't find that there was error in 1974 based on evidence from, say, 1980. It's just in the nature of the inquiry that you would need to focus on the facts as they were in the decision that is the focus of the inquiry. But again, to borrow from the example I made earlier, if the error you found was something else, say the failure to provide a copy of the claims file that I mentioned, then of course you'd be looking at more recent evidence in your harmless error analysis. You'd be looking at evidence bearing on whether the claimant actually received this claims file, or whether notwithstanding the lack of receipt of the claims file, he was nonetheless able to craft his arguments. So again, it all flows from the nature of the error. But again, typically, where you're looking at the outcome, then you're looking at the evidence that's relevant to the outcome, and in Q, that is the evidence as it was here in 1974. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, but when you gave the example of the copy of the claims file, you weren't talking about that as a Q, as a basis for Q. You're talking about
correct.
A non-Q context.
I'm talking about if the claims file was not provided, say in this case, Mr. Simmons submitted his motion for Q, and contemporaneously with that passed for a copy of the claim. And that was in the problem. The board's error would be these Q proceedings as opposed to looking previously. So the evidence bearing on the prejudice of the current error would be more recent evidence as opposed to evidence before the IRA. If that makes sense. So if there are no further questions, Your Honor, it would be that, again, the Secretary's contention that the board actually made no error here with respect to 105A, and to the extent it may have, the board clearly explained, by virtue of its reference to the unfavorable nexus evidence, that any such error would be not prejudicial.
Thank you.
Please, of course,
I'm describing what the board did in this case in relationship to the relationship between the diagnosis of a mental disorder and holding in the therapy based upon a later diagnosis. And I concur that that's what the board did. However, I think it's important for this court to examine, notwithstanding how the board characterized it, what the agency actually did in 1974. At page 1448 of the record, the second page of the 1974 rating decision under the letter D, which presumably stands for decision, the second full sentence says, the currently diagnosed anxiety reaction is not seen to be related to the immature personality shown before which he was separated from SDC. Now, it seems to me there that that is a clear A, acceptance of a current diagnosis in 1974 of a post-service mental disorder. Second, it is an acknowledgement that there is no relationship between what was separately diagnosed in service in three different service records as a mental disorder that was predicated initially upon a suicide attempt as somehow being the same as a personality disorder, or in this case what was characterized as an immature personality. A diagnosis of a personality disorder has nothing to do with suicidal ideation or suicidal attempts. We are dealing here with the identification of a mental disorder while on active duty that flows from a suicide attempt. That fact triggered the presumption under 105 as well as the presumption under 1111. The government also talks in terms of the analysis, whether it is under the umbrella of manifest or different outcome or under the umbrella of prejudicial error analysis, should focus upon the essential fairness. And that seems to me to be the point of this argument and the urging of Mr. Simmons for this panel not to go down the road of a prejudicial error analysis that will undermine the importance and value of statutory and regulatory presumption. Because if this court were, based upon what the board did, to make a determination that there was an analysis of the value of the presumption under both of these statutory presumptions, and that the court finds that these presumptions were not correctly applied, it undermines for every veteran seeking revision and every advocate trying to frame a request for revision, to frame a request that is going to be successful in putting through the needle the camel. Because if the camel in the manifestly different outcome is so large that you cannot overcome it because the court is going to step in and make the review that the board should have done, that seems to undermine the value of the presumption. If this court makes a finding that the 105A presumption was not correctly applied, there is no way that this court can make a non-prejudicial finding based upon what's in the board's decision. Because all that was said was the mere declaration that it wouldn't have changed the outcome. That should not be an adequate statement of reasons or bases for this court to find that they can do a non-prejudicial error analysis. And this court should recognize, as Judge Davis suggested to the government, is there some guidance that this court can offer? I believe that the guidance that this court can offer is to define with specificity what the effect is of a statutory or regulatory presumption, so that the government as well as the parties will know what you get when you are entitled to that presumption. and more importantly, in this case, what you did not get. And the effect of what Mr. Simmons did not get was the opportunity for his case to be considered with the benefit of the presumption that his mental disorder was incurred in service. He didn't get that in the 1974 adjudication. That adjudication was flawed. At the very least, this court needs to send this matter back to the board for re-adjudication of the request for revision with directions to consider the effects of both of those presumptions, which the government concedes were not considered by the agency.
Would there be any problem in taking this route with Sanders itself, in the sense that it seems like the Supreme Court was pretty clear about not adopting hard and fast rules? And wouldn't this be equivalent to saying that in a case in which we're talking about a statutory or regulatory presumption, that we will, it would be equivalent to us presuming prejudice in those situations automatically?
I want to make sure I understand what you're asking. Are you asking me, would that be the end result?
Well, yeah, I think step one would, it sounds like that's basically what the argument you're making is, that when there is a presumption, so here a presumption of in the line of duty, and the board in a Q context errs by not affording that presumption.
Yeah.
I think the rule you're saying is that is inherently prejudicial.
I'm saying that, yes.
Well, I'm not taking a position on that one way or the other.
And I don't mean to equivocate, but I want to clarify that what makes it inherent is what the role is, both historically and as accepted in the case law of this court and the Federal Circuit, of statutory and regulatory presumptions. They are a substitute for evidence. It relieves the veteran of the burden of coming forward with evidence to prove a matter at issue. Essentially, the baby was thrown out with the bathwater here because the presumption was not applied. The failure to apply statutory presumption should be viewed by this court as comparable to the void ab initio analysis that this court has made in reduction cases. This court has said the protective regulations that are required by the agency pre-reduction, if they are not applied, any decision that reduces is void as a matter of law. Well, clearly, when a presumption is afforded by Congress, or when the VA itself creates a regulatory presumption, then those presumptions have to be afforded for there to be the essential fairness of an adjudication. And when the board simply declares that a presumption does not apply, and in so saying is wrong as a matter of law, because what they said was it didn't apply because there was a personality disorder noted in the medical records. Well, there is no case law that supports that proposition. A personality disorder is non-compensable. The fact that out of four examinations, one of the four said that it was a personality disorder, okay, he's not entitled to compensation for the personality disorder. But that in no way bars or otherwise precludes consideration for the mental disorder that was noted in the three other service medical records.
Can you just address this? I'm wondering how far we're going with your analysis, similar to Dodell. Let's say you had a pension applicant, and you know that a few years ago there was a rule put into place, it's probably more than a few years ago, that was essentially a presumption that said that if you're 65 or older, you meet the permanent and total requirement. Let's assume that the board did not apply that rule. And they found that he wasn't permanent and total when he appealed. But it's clear also from the record, something that the board didn't mention, that he didn't have wartime service. Would you expect us to send that back down for the board to correct its error as to permanent and total, even though we know we could find that that error was harmless because he didn't have wartime service?
Counsel, the time has expired. Would you please answer Judge Bartlett's question?
I do not believe that I would have that expectation on this court, because I think that falls into the category of cases in which the law does not support the award. You cannot make that conclusion in this case because the statutory presumption was not afforded. This court does not know what would have happened in 1974 had that presumption been afforded. In your pension analysis, you clearly know that because the veteran lacked wartime service, that he is, as a matter of law, precluded. I don't remember the case name.
So everything is hinging on our agreement with you that the June 74 opinion was... satisfied a nexus requirement, essentially.
No, Your Honor. It is not. That goes to why I think it is arguable that there was a manifestly different outcome. I am saying that when you are judging the question of a failure to consider a statutory or regulatory presumption, that this court should adopt the rule as was articulated by Judge Allen, that it is inherently prejudicial because the statute, because Congress mandated that presumption be applied. And
yeah, well, that's why I was trying to come up with the pension, which is essentially, to me, a presumption that you're permanent and total.
With respect, Ron, I think the problem with your analogy is that it's binary, because it's either or. You are either entitled to the pension, or you're not entitled to the pension. And by having no wartime service, you're not entitled as a matter of law, whether you qualify by age or not. So the difficulty in that analogy, and that's why I want to make sure that you do not understand my argument to be dependent upon 49, RBA page 49. It is dependent upon the nature of statutory and regulatory presumptions, that they have a substance at law that cannot be allowed to be ignored by an adjudicator in a non-adversarial system. When Congress or VA mandates that a presumption be afforded, the presumption needs to be afforded.
May I ask one?
Absolutely.
So it sounds a bit like in the world of ineffective assistance of counsel, say, or constitutional claims, most claims are subject to purely harmless error review. But there are some errors that are deemed to be structural errors. That's what the constitutional phrase is. So, for example, the complete abandonment by counsel. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. Are you basically saying that in the world in which everything is subject to harmless error here, there are some things that are like structural error in the constitutional context, and this is one of them? Would that be a fair characterization?
Yes, and that's why I made the analogy to this court's void ab initio analysis in reduction cases. That, yes, there are some instances, and I believe that statutory and regulatory presumptions are such an instance, that are so structurally substantive to this non-adversarial system, that the leg up is that presumption, and the failure to consider and apply that has to be regarded as something that is not presumptively, but inherently a prejudice. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and recounsel.